From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, praying for peace in the Middle East, Egypt's new leader sworn in, legal hurdles keeping scores of prisoners detained in Guantanamo, plus penguins, a barometer of ocean health. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Pope Francis welcomed Israeli President Shimon Peres and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to the Vatican on Sunday for an evening of peace prayers, just weeks after the last round of U.S.-sponsored negotiations collapsed.
Desidero ringraziare tutti coloro che personalmente.
The Pope said he wanted to thank everyone who made the meeting possible and all those who will join in the prayers for peace. This is Yusuf Salman, a representative of the Palestinian Red Crescent movement in Italy. He said, "We hope that this peace meeting will be different from all other meetings that have taken place so far." He said, "I hope people are aware that this peace process has suffered enough on both sides." Vatican officials have insisted that Pope Francis has no political agenda by inviting the two leaders to pray with him, other than to rekindle a desire for peace between the two parties. In other news, Egyptian leader Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has been sworn in as president after winning a landslide victory that was never in doubt. The former military chief promised to build a more stable country after 3 years of upheaval. VOA's Elizabeth Arendt has more from Cairo.
Egypt's former army chief, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, took the presidential oath of office Sunday, normalizing his role as the nation's leader.
In the name of God, I swear that I will be loyal to the republican system and will respect the Constitution, take care of the nation, and maintain the nation's independence, its unity, and security.
But the nation is far from united or secure. Less than a year after he led the ouster of Egypt's first freely elected president, Islamist Mohamed Morsi, Mr. Sisi faces a deeply polarized nation, an economy on the brink, and growing resentment of Egypt once again led by a man from the military with little tolerance for dissent. The new president promised to build a more stable future, called on Egyptians to work hard, and for the development of freedom. The crowds that came out on Cairo's Tahrir Square to celebrate the beginning of Mr. Sisi's four-year term were small compared to past rallies in his name, but those that did turn out were a reminder of the yearning for stability after frequent chaos since the 2011 revolution.
I congratulate Mr. President on the swearing in today. May God make it a happy year for us and for all Egyptians. And I hope God will save us from the previous situation and we will be good people. God willing, as he said, we will be the mother of civilization.
Taking no chances, Cairo officials declared a state of emergency for the day, ramping up already tight security in the capital. As for economic stability, Mr. Sisi thanked Saudi Arabia for organizing a donor conference for Egypt, offsetting a reluctance by the United States and other Western powers to fully endorse his election. But as familiar as the sight of another military man becoming president, one thing was new. As interim president Adli Mansour passed the mantle to Mr. Sisi, it marked the first time an Egyptian president came to office not because his predecessor died, was assassinated, or in the case of two recent presidents, deposed and imprisoned. Elizabeth Arad, VOA News, Cairo.
Iraqi officials say a double bombing outside a Kurdish party office has killed at least 18 people, wounded more than 65 others. Sunday's blast, including a suicide attack, occurred near an office of President Jalal Talabani's Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, which is near a security forces building. The second bomb went off as emergency workers came to the scene of the first blast. This witness said a bomb went off in a parked car, clearly killing and wounding people. There's been no claim of responsibility for the attack, which struck northeast of Baghdad in the town of Jalula in Diyala province. And on Saturday, an attack by Iraqi militants on Anbar University in the city of Ramadi followed raids in the cities of Mosul and Samarra. The UN says the deadly assault in Ramadi by militants who killed several guards and seized dozens of students as hostages highlights the chaotic situation enveloping Anbar province for months. We get more now from Lisa Schlein at the UN in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says the growing violence in this Sunni-dominated province is creating a displacement crisis. It estimates nearly 500,000 people have fled their homes since fighting between Shia-led government forces and Sunni rebels in eastern Anbar escalated in January. UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards says people flee according to the shifting waves of fighting. For example, he says last month, some 72,000 Iraqis were forced to flee their homes when militants deliberately breached a dam in Anbar's Abu Ghraib district.
The floodwaters have subsided and people are returning to their homes. There are now health and recovery worries. Access to clean water is a pressing concern because the flooding damaged water treatment plants. Local officials say 28 tanker truckloads of potable water are being delivered to the area each day, but this is only meeting about 50% of needs.
Edward says the UNHCR is bracing for a possible exodus of people from the city of Fallujah, which recently came under shelling. He says the attack hit a hospital and water plant, making life in the city very difficult. UNAID workers report tens of thousands of Iraqi citizens have fled Anbar province and are spread throughout the country. They say large concentrations of displaced people are found in Salah al-Din, an autonomous Sunni governorate north of Baghdad. Others are in Erbil, Kirkuk, Sulaymaniyah in Kurdistan, and in the capital, Baghdad. Edward says many of the displaced are struggling to cope in desperate conditions.
The more fortunate are living with friends and relatives. Others, though, are in tents, schools, unfinished buildings, other types of communal shelter. In Anbar governorate alone, almost two-thirds of the 300,000 people displaced there are living in schools. Displaced people are telling us that housing stock is limited, becoming increasingly expensive. Most people are without income. People are going into debt, trying to pay for essential needs. Families say access to housing and food is really their top priority.
Edward says the UNHCR has provided emergency relief kits and other items to more than 40,000 people, as well as cash assistance to 2,500 of the most vulnerable. But he notes this is only a fraction of what is needed. He says the agency would like to urgently ramp up its humanitarian operation, but cannot because it only has received 12% of its $26.4 million appeal. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Ukraine's new president, Petro Poroshenko, faces his first challenge this week, negotiating a contentious natural gas deal with Russia that also threatens Europe's supply. Ukrainian, Russian, and European Union energy officials are set to meet today in Brussels, even as armed clashes between Kiev's security forces and pro-Russian separatists continue unabated in eastern Ukraine. Mr. Poroshenko was sworn in as Ukraine's president on Saturday and offered a whole peaceful dialogue with the pro-Russian insurgency in the east. He wants to end that. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports now from Kiev.
Mr. Poroshenko took the oath of office at the parliament building in central Kiev, officially taking control of a country in crisis. Ukraine's armed forces have been battling a separatist rebellion in two eastern provinces near the Russian border. Fighting has intensified in recent weeks. Mr. Poroshenko offered amnesty to rebels who, in his words, do not have the blood of Ukrainian warriors and peaceful people on their hands. He also proposed opening a corridor for Russian mercenaries to leave and a peaceful dialogue with citizens of the East. I don't want war, the new president said. stressing that he is not seeking revenge, despite the big sacrifices already made by the people of Ukraine during the political crisis and standoff with Russia. Mr. Poroshenko addressed Eastern Ukrainians directly in a section of his speech in Russian. He promised a decentralization of power, respect for local communities, as well as new regional elections. Mr. Poroshenko has already held brief talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin about a possible ceasefire. They spoke Friday in France during the ceremonies commemorating the World War II battles of D-Day. Russia enraged Ukraine by annexing Crimea in March after separatists there staged an unauthorized referendum to declare themselves independent from Kiev. Many Ukrainians also blame Russia for fueling violence in the east, where Russian fighters have been seen among rebels battling Ukrainian government troops. Moscow has repeatedly denied it is directing the rebels or has supplied the modern military equipment the separatist fighters use. Mr. Poroshenko's supporters are watching to see how he will engage with Mr. Putin. Taras, a Kiev resident standing outside St. Sophia's Cathedral with his wife and infant son, says he thinks dialogue is the way forward.
На сьогоднішній день він должен стабілізувати ситуацію в стране. Як би там ні було, він должен вести переговори.
Poroshenko has to negotiate with Putin, he says, because only by negotiations can we find a solution. The new president, he says, should demolish the terrorists and restore order in the country. Mr. Poroshenko was elected by a wide margin in May, rising to power on a wave of nationalism that followed the ousting of his Russian-backed predecessor, Viktor Yanukovych, during protests in February. He first came to prominence in Ukraine as a businessman, earning billions from his chain of Roshan candy stores. Archbishop Stefan of Ukraine's Orthodox Church wonders if Mr. Poroshenko's money will get in the way of his ability to lead the people.
Що його, успішного бізнесмена, який якимось чином накопичував первісний капітал.
If Mr. Poroshenko, as a businessman, can be replanted into a position where he takes care of other people instead of his business, will he succeed? The Archbishop asks, adding, I don't know, but we will pray that he will. Ukraine has long been divided between the pro-Russian East and the Europe-leaning West. Mr. Poroshenko has already promised greater economic and diplomatic ties with Europe, a move that could anger Moscow and complicate his efforts to unite the country. Gabe Joselow, VOA News, Kyiv.
Ruling Democratic Party of Kosovo is claiming victory in a likely third term for Prime Minister Hashim Thaçi. Early results from Sunday's parliamentary election give the party 31% of the vote, while the main opposition Democratic League of Kosovo has 25%. Nonpartisan exit poll also puts Mr. Thaçi's party in front. Former guerrilla fighter is the only leader Kosovo has had since winning independence from Serbia in 2008. He says a successful election will send a message to Europe that Kosovo is a democracy. This voter said, if there are changes, for sure there will be improvements, but we continue with the same people. I don't see any future, she says. Kosovo has its sights set on joining the European Union, but economic progress has been painfully slow, with 35% unemployment and corruption a major problem. It's been more than 12 years since the administration of U.S. President George W. Bush reopened the doors of the detention camp at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Nearly 800 detainees have been there since the onset of the so-called global war on terror. Human rights groups say the detentions are illegal, but the U.S. government says they're necessary, despite promises by President Obama to close the camp. Arash Arabasadi has our report.
It started in 2002, 4 months after the September 11 attacks that fueled the U.S.-led war on terror. The detainees were all Muslim. Some were as young as 18. Of the 149 still held today, 38 are classified detained indefinitely. Nicholas Rostow is a former senior advisor to the U.S. government and served as a special assistant to Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush.
In the view of the administration, and it's the previous administration, the detainees at Guantanamo were not combatants as defined in the Geneva Conventions and therefore not entitled to prisoner of war status upon capture.
In 1949, the Geneva Conventions established the rules of war, giving rights to uniformed soldiers of signatory countries who were captured on the battlefield. Carly Stimson is a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation.
But it was decided early on that if we captured detainees, we had to decide what their legal status would be. You get the full protections of the Geneva Conventions if you're a country that has signed and ratified the Geneva Conventions.
The United States treats these detainees as prisoners of war, with the understanding they will be returned to their home country when the war on terror ends. The United States does not see that end coming soon.
It's better than the alternative. We've decided that it's better to detain somebody humanely and feed and clothe them and water them and whatnot than to kill them. Because the ultimate deprivation of liberty is killing somebody, whereas depriving somebody of the ability to fight on a battlefield is an inconvenience compared to death.
And that's where things got tricky.
The complicating factor was that the Taliban was the ruling party in Afghanistan when 9/11 happened. And only three countries recognized the Taliban as the legitimate ruling party of Afghanistan. We weren't one of those three countries, naturally.
While the U.S. government plans to hold some Guantanamo detainees indefinitely, for the rest, there are only limited options.
These aren't the most palatable people, and so it's a little hard to find places that'll take them. And some of them are awaiting trial or should be tried, either by military commission or by civilian courts.
President Obama said 6 years ago that he would close the doors at Guantanamo Bay. He has yet to make good on that promise, and in light of a recent prisoner exchange with the Taliban, that closing date may be even harder to predict. Aras Arabasadi for VOA News, Washington.
You can see Arash's report by going to our website, voanews.com. World's oceans are under assault. Many fisheries are on the brink of collapse, and 90% of the largest fish are overfished. The increasing concentration of global carbon emissions is making waters warmer and more acidic, which is harming coral reefs, home to about one-third of everything that lives in the sea. One barometer of ocean health is the penguin, whose southern hemisphere range extends from the tropical Galapagos Islands near the equator to the ice shelf of Antarctica. VOA's Roseanne Scribble reports on the penguin's struggle for survival in the face of numerous threats.
Penguins are aquatic birds. They don't fly. Instead, they soar through the ocean. Penguins are especially adapted to life in the water and are affected by everything in it. They suffer from pollution and overfishing, which limits their food source. They're in danger from shipping traffic and oil spills. Vanessa Strauss, who heads a high-tech tracking and monitoring program at the South African Foundation for the Conservation of Coastal Birds in Cape Town, says accidents there have accelerated the birds' sharp decline.
We know that some animals that are oiled at sea never make it to land, so it's really difficult to quantify the impact of chronic oil pollution over the long term. We cannot only look at the number of birds affected by oil to quantify the impact, but we do know from research that many birds do die out at sea.
Climate change puts all penguin populations at risk, says Andrea Kavanaugh, director of Global Penguin Conservation for the Pew Charitable Trusts.
And global warming is a problem because it shifts where their normal food supplies are, either further away from them, so they have to swim further and further away to get food. And when penguins are nesting and trying to protect their chicks, that's especially a big problem for them because the longer they have to leave their chicks, the more open to predation and starvation their chicks are.
Two-thirds of the global penguin population is endangered, according to the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. Eight species of 18 worldwide live in Antarctica. The continent is one of the world's last wild frontiers and home to 10,000 species, including seabirds, seals, and whales, as well as penguins. Kavanaugh says Pew and partner groups are backing a plan to create two large marine reserves, which would set aside nearly 3 million square kilometers in the Ross Sea and East Antarctica, more than one-third of which would be a strict no-fishing zone.
Marine reserves help penguins because Number one, it would move fisheries away from where the penguins have to forage for food. And so it would give them a little bit more security when it comes to their food source in the face of a changing climate. The other thing that it would do is it would take a big fishery that's happening, the krill fishery, and move that further away from their foraging grounds.
The tiny shrimp-like krill is a staple of the penguin diet, but it's being harvested for fish feed and vitamin supplements. A commission created under the Antarctic Treaty, which governs the continent, is currently negotiating the fate of the reserves. The 24 member states and the European Union must come to a consensus. Kavanaugh says every nation is on board except Russia, which has been reluctant to give up fishing in the proposed area.
So the last couple years, we've been working with our Russian colleagues and with all of the other member governments to try to understand their problems and see if we can work through them so that this year, this October, we can have these marine reserves firmly established.
The meeting will be in Tasmania, where the commission is based. The reserves would double the area of ocean worldwide that is fully protected. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington. From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians. Sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
This with all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
For anyone with World Cup fever, you can't make it to Brazil this week for the games, well, there are ways to soak up that excitement and the flavor of the country without missing even a moment. In one of Washington, D.C.'s most eclectic neighborhoods, there is a bar whose infectious rhythm will transport you without you ever leaving the United States. Here's VOA's Ramon Taylor.
This is Adams Morgan, a colorful neighborhood in Washington with international restaurants and bars as diverse as the capital city itself. With just days to go before the World Cup officially kicks off in Sao Paulo, Brazil, there is one lounge called Bolsa that stands out from the rest. Yela Natalie is the manager.
When you come in, it feels like Brazil. The patrons are Brazilian. It's so much fun. We dance, we sweat, we drink caipirinhas. It really is a lot like being back home.
The Brazilians here take pride in their craft of mixing the caipirinha, the national cocktail of Brazil. It's a concoction of lime, sugar, and a fermented sugarcane-based spirit called cachaça.
That's it, caipirinha.
As winners of five World Cup titles, Brazilians also take pride in futebol, or soccer.
Bring it. For all of the people like myself who can't get back to Brazil for the Copa, it's happening here at Bossa. We're ready. We're going to show it. It's going to be crazy in here with Brazilians, and we are going to get that trophy.
Whether you're a proud expatriate or simply a curious first-time visitor, there is something for everyone here. Just up the stairs, Bolsa offers Brazilian dance classes from various regions of the country.
And make sure your hand is pressed here.
In fact, if you enter the lounge, you might just think, for a moment, that the tournament was about to take place right here.
It's a very positive atmosphere. It's very much Brazilian, because I feel like Brazilian people, for the most part, are like that friendly, welcoming, positive, fun.
The first thing that I learned with samba, even before I knew what it was that this feeling of happiness. You have to let yourself enjoy the music and let it be your first dance partner.
Samba instructor Demetrius Hale is an American, originally from Louisiana, but she's a Brazilian at heart. She teaches a dance called Samba de Gafieira, a couple's variation of samba. Hale describes music as the other international language, a language that makes people smile and transcends international boundaries.
If I could put everybody on a plane and bring them here, I would. I would be like, the quickest way to Brazil is to come to Bossa. You don't need a passport and you have to wait for a visa.
Reporting from Washington, D.C., I'm Ramon Taylor for VOA News.
So Sounds like fun, doesn't it? By the way, it looks like the strikes that are going on down in Brazil and Rio and in Sao Paulo will be over in time for the games, but Brazilian officials assuring everyone that even if there are strikes, they will not be having any effect on the football games as they begin later this week. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. A reminder, the latest world news is coming up shortly. We hope you'll stay tuned for that. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
This is Today in History. On June 9th in the year 68, the Roman Emperor Nero died after imploring his secretary to kill him. By committing suicide, Nero hoped to avoid a Senate-imposed death by flogging. Contemporaries described Nero's rule in Rome as marked by tyranny and cruelty. In 1672, Peter the Great of Russia was born. He introduced Western influence and reform to Russia, transforming the nation into a major European power. On this day in 1898, Britain and China signed a treaty under which Britain would lease Hong Kong and surrounding territories for a period of 99 years. Britain wanted to safeguard the colony it had secured 50 years earlier in the Treaty of Nanking. Britain relinquished sovereignty of the territory to the People's Republic of China in 1997. In 1954, at the height of the anti-communist Red Scare, a dramatic confrontation occurred during U.S. Senate hearings on communist infiltration into the U.S. armed forces. The special counsel for the U.S. Army, Joseph Welch, lashed out at the dishonest tactics of his interrogator, Senator Joseph McCarthy.
Have you no sense of decency, sir, at long last? Have you left no sense of decency?
Ultimately, McCarthy's inability to substantiate his claims led to his censure by the U.S. Senate. On this day in 1934, this cartoon character made his film debut. Donald Duck appeared in Walt Disney's The Wise Little Hen and would become one of Disney's most beloved characters. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
We are deeply concerned by reports that one of the bloggers who met with Secretary of State John Kerry during his last trip to Beijing has been fired from his job. U.S. Department of State spokesperson Jen Psaki said in response to questions from the press on May 29, 2014. If the reports are true, we would be very troubled that a private sector employee would be fired by his company for publicly expressing his or her views. The blogger, Zhang Jialong, is a popular voice on the Chinese internet and has become known for his defense of free speech. Mr. Zhang was one of the four Chinese writers invited to meet with Secretary of State Kerry February 15th in Beijing. At the meeting with Secretary Kerry, Mr. Zhang expressed his opinions on China's internet controls and his concern about people being imprisoned for speaking their minds. He reportedly asked Secretary Kerry, "Will you get together with the Chinese who aspire for freedom and help tear down this great firewall that blocks the internet?" Mr. Zhang's case highlights some of the difficulties faced by journalists and bloggers in China, ranging from repercussions from employers to government harassment and other curbs on freedom of expression. The United States remains concerned by the continuing crackdown on freedom of speech and expression on the internet and by the detention and prosecution of bloggers in China, spokesperson Psaki said. We urge Chinese authorities to guarantee all Chinese citizens the rights of free expression, association, religion, and peaceful assembly.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.